When the topic for discussion is as controversial as my present subject matter, political economy, any audience is entitled to know at the very outset where the speaker stands philosophically. Perhaps I can reveal my general position by relating a recent experience. Two engagements had been accepted in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The first, a luncheon with 200 clergymen. The second, a dinner with 400 high school teachers. I boarded an early jet at Idlewild for Chicago's O'Hare Field. 20 minutes before our scheduled arrival, the captain reported over the intercom, "Sorry, this whole area is socked in. We are landing at St. Louis." This put me 350 miles from Kenosha with no chance of keeping the luncheon engagement and grave doubts about the dinner meeting. Luckily, I was able to board a DC-3 shortly after noon with scheduled stops at Springfield, Peoria, Moline, Clinton, Iowa, and Milwaukee. We made our destination at 5 p.m., landing in rain and fog. I was met and driven to Kenosha just in time to join the high school teachers at dinner. The MC, when introducing me, referred mostly to the miserable weather our speaker has gone through. I began my speech by saying, "Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know that I like today's weather, or any weather. In fact, I like heat, cold, rain, hail, sleet, fog, snow. This is my way of expressing appreciation that God, not the government, is in charge." Now to my controversial topic. G.K. Chesterton once observed, "It is not that Christianity has been tried and found wanting. It is that it has been tried and found difficult and abandoned." Perhaps much the same thing can be said about freedom. It is not that freedom has been tried and found wanting. Rather, it is that freedom has been tried and found to require self-responsibility and all but abandoned by the American people. Freedom, as I view it, divides into two broad and distinct categories, the psychological and the sociological. The psychological has to do with man freeing himself from his own fears, frustrations, superstitions, imperfections, ignorance. While this phase may be the more important of the two, because it is fundamental to the other, it is not to be the subject of this discourse. Instead, I shall dwell only on the sociological aspect of freedom, this having to do with man imposing his will by force upon others. We should, all of us, concentrate on freeing ourselves from our own ignorance, for this is a never-ending, upgrading, glorious task. This is what we are here for. On the other hand, we should not, any of us, find it necessary to free ourselves from the domination of others, for it is absurd that we should be in this predicament, yet we are, and on the grand scale. The absurdity of having to free ourselves from those who would and do impose their will upon us by force can be demonstrated by asking a simple question to which the answer is obvious. The question is this: what moral right have I forcibly to direct and control that which you shall invent, discover, create, where you shall work, what your wage shall be, how long you shall labor, what and with whom you shall exchange, or what thoughts you shall entertain? No doubt everyone will agree that I have no such rights of forcible direction and control over any other person. And, if logical, everyone would have to agree that no combinations of persons, even a majority of adult Americans, or even any agencies they might contrive, be they government or otherwise, have any moral right to forcibly direct and control any person's productive and creative actions. Perhaps we can get a better idea of this by reflecting on the manner in which man's energies tend to manifest themselves. As I see it, man's energies manifest themselves either destructively or creatively. If, for example, I use my hand to build a home or paint a picture or write a book or strew seed, This is an example of my energy manifesting itself productively or creatively. But if I were to take this same hand and make a clenched fist of it and strike you in the face, this would be an example of my energy manifesting itself destructively. Now, any person on earth, I care not who he is, has a moral right to defend himself against the destructive action of another or others. And he has a right to organize for that defense. But there is no person who has any moral right forcibly to direct or to control the productive and or the creative actions of any other living person. Let us now take a brief look at our own history, that we may better see how important the sociological aspect of freedom has become. Go back a little more than three centuries to the year 1620, the occasion of the landing of our Pilgrim Fathers at Plymouth Rock. That little colony began its career in a state of pure and unadulterated communism, for it made no difference how much or how little any member of that colony produced. All of their produce went into a common warehouse under authority, and the proceeds of the warehouse were doled out in accordance with the authority's idea of the need. In short, these Pilgrim Fathers began the practice of a principle which more than two centuries later Karl Marx advanced as the ideal of the Communist Party, which was from each according to ability, to each according to need, and by force. Now, there was a compelling reason why our Pilgrim Fathers gave up this communalistic or communistic practice. It was because many members of the colony were starving and dying. As a rule, this kind of an experience causes persons to reflect upon what they have been doing. They did, indeed, do some hard thinking. It was during the third winter that they met with Governor Bradford, who in effect said to them, "Come next spring, we are going to try a new idea. We shall drop the idea of from each according to ability to each according to need. We shall try in its stead the idea of to each according to merit." When Governor Bradford made this pronouncement, he set forth the principle of private property as clearly as any economist ever did, the principle being only that each individual has a right to the fruits of his own labor. Governor Bradford ended his remarks by telling his colleagues that each of them from now on was to have what each produced. And according to the record, when next spring came around, not only was father in the field, but for the first time, mother and the children were there also. It was the practice of this private property principle that brought to this land of ours an era of growth and prosperity, which sooner or later had to lead to revolutionary political ideas, and it did lead to what I refer to as the American Revolution. Now, I never think of the American Revolution as the armed conflict which we had with King George III. That was a reasonably minor fracas as such affairs go. The real American Revolution was a revolutionary concept or idea. It was a break with the whole political history of the world. For up until 1776, men had been contesting with each other and killing each other by the millions over the age-old question of which one of these numerous forms of man-made authority, that is, authoritarianism, should preside as sovereign over man. The argument had not been between authoritarianism on the one hand and freedom on the other, but only between this or that brand of authoritarianism. And then in 1776, in the fraction of one sentence, came this revolutionary idea, this break with the whole political history of the world, this thought or concept which I refer to as the essence of Americanism. It was simply this, that men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty. This revolutionary concept was at once a spiritual, a political, and an economic concept. It was spiritual in that the writers of the Declaration believed and proclaimed that the Creator is the endower of men's rights, thus establishing the Creator as sovereign. It was political in that by saying such a thing, they implicitly denied that the state is the endower of men's rights, thus unseating the state as sovereign. And it was economic in this sense: if an individual has a right to his life, it follows that he has a right to sustain his life, the sustenance of life being nothing more nor less than the fruits of one's own labor. It is one thing to adopt such a revolutionary concept as this. It is quite another matter to implement it, to put it into practice. To accomplish this, our founding fathers added two political instruments, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. These two political instruments were essentially a set of prohibitions. Prohibitions not against the people themselves, but prohibitions against the thing the people from their old world experience had learned to fear, namely, overextended government. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights more severely limited government than government had ever before been limited. If you will review these two political documents, you will note that there are 46 specific instances of governmental negation. These were, in effect, pronouncements of limitation. Government, these are areas for the citizens in free and unfettered action. Keep your hands off. There were benefits that flowed from this unprecedented limitation of the state. Number one, once this arrangement got underway, the people did not turn to government for security, welfare, or prosperity, simply because so limited a government had nothing on hand to dispense, nor did it have the power to take from some that it might give to others. Now, what do a people do who cannot turn to government for security, welfare, and prosperity? To whom or to what do they turn? They turn to where they should turn, namely to themselves. As a result of this discipline, founded on the revolutionary concept that the creator, not the state, is sovereign, there developed among our people a quality of character that Emerson referred to as self-reliance. All over the world, Americans gained the reputation of being a self-reliant people. Then there was another benefit that flowed from this severe limitation of government. With government limited to the invoking of a common justice, inhibiting and penalizing fraud, violence, and predation, or, as I sometimes put it, to keeping the peace, there could not and did not then exist any organized force standing against the releasing of creative energies. And as a consequence of this limitation, we experienced a freeing of creative energy, again on an unprecedented scale, and through the persons of self-reliant individuals. We have here the formula mainly responsible for the American miracle, founded on what I believe to be the truth: the creator, not the state, is the endower of man's rights. This way of life showed forth as individual freedom of choice. People had freedom of choice as to how they employed themselves, and in pricing their own services, their own steel, their own aluminum, their own copper. They had freedom of choice as to what they did with the fruits of their own labor. But something happened to this remarkable idea, this newest of all human formulas, this revolutionary concept. It seemed that the people we place in government office as our agents to keep the peace made a discovery. Having acquisitive instincts for affluence and power over others, as indeed do many of us, they discovered that the force which inheres in government, that force the people had delegated to them to inhibit destructive actions, could be used to invade the productive and creative areas, one of which is the business sector. They also found that if they incurred any deficits by their interventions, the same force could be used to collect the wherewithal to pay the bills. I would like to suggest that the extent to which government has departed from the original design of inhibiting destructive actions, invoking a common justice, and keeping the peace, the extent to which government has invaded the productive and creative areas, the extent to which government has assumed the responsibility for the security, welfare, and prosperity of our people, is a measure of the extent to which socialism and communism have developed in this land of ours. Can this devolution be measured? I think it can. Merely make reference to one of the characteristics that featured the original design, namely, that each individual has freedom of choice as to what he does with the fruits of his own labor. Bear in mind that freedom of choice exists, except as authoritarianism is invoked. Thus, if we measure the loss in freedom of choice that the average citizen has experienced with his own income, we will get an idea of how much authoritarianism has taken over, socialism, communism, call it what you will, being founded on authoritarianism, no exception. There was a time, about 120 years ago, when the average citizen had somewhere between 95 and 98% freedom of choice as to what he did with each of his income dollars. That was because the take of government, federal, state, and local, was between 2 and 5% of the earned income of the people. But as government began more and more to invade the productive and creative areas with the inevitable deficits, as government more and more assumed the responsibility for the welfare, security, and prosperity of the people, the percentage of the take of the people's earned income, regardless of how much the earned income went up, the percentage of the take of the earned income kept going up and up until today. It is no longer 2 to 5% of the earned income of the people. It stands now at approximately 41% and grows apace. Some of my friends claim that we should not be concerned about this, that after all, on the average, we still have a 59% freedom of choice with our earned income. Permit me to interpolate for a moment and suggest that we should be careful how we use this term on the average. Take a 40-hour week. A person goes to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, takes an hour off for luncheon, works until 5, Monday through Friday, that's 40 hours. The average person has to work Monday, Tuesday, and until 9:24 a.m. on Wednesday for government before he can start working for himself. But if the individual has been extraordinarily successful, he finds that he has to work all day Monday, all day Tuesday, all day Wednesday, and until late afternoon on Thursday for government before he can start working for himself. He has little more than a day to work for himself. This, I take it, is a part of the new incentive system. Nonetheless, on the average, we do have 59% freedom of choice with our earned income. However, you will be well advised to take no solace from this fact. Research into the fiscal behavior of nations covering a period of many centuries reveals that whenever the take of the people's earned income reaches that high level where it is no longer politically expedient to collect the costs of government by direct tax levies, that governments have throughout history and do today resort to inflation as a means of financing their interventionist programs. What is that high level where political expediency dictates inflation? There are some exceptions, but as a rule, it is when the costs of government rise to 20 to 25% of the people's earned income. That's a takeoff point for inflation. Keep in mind that we are now at the 41% level. What do I mean by inflation? Not what most people mean. Inflation is popularly conceived as a rise in prices, but a price rise is not inflation. It is only one of the possible and likely consequences of inflation. Inflation is a dilution of the medium of exchange, the money supply. Inflation to the economist is the same as counterfeiting. To the lawyer, it has the distinction of being legal. Governments have always inflated, diluted the medium of exchange with popular approval. The reason for the popularity is the economic naivety of most people. They think they can have their cake and eat it too, as the saying goes. That is, they believe they can continue to receive the so-called benefits from government without having to pay for them. They think this only because the payments are not made by direct tax levies. they fail to see that inflation is an obscure, sneaky tax on fixed assets, a point I shall explain in a moment. Inflation, without question, is the cruelest and most unjust form of taxation ever devised. Historically, inflation has taken varied forms. Some have been clever, others crude. In short, there are numerous ways to skin a cat. Recall coin clipping. The sovereign called in the coin of the realm, clipped and kept the edges, returning the reduced coins to the owners. This rather stupid hocus-pocus had one advantage. It couldn't last very long, for soon the pieces were too small to return. During the French Revolutionary period, France was in dire financial straits. The government began the issuance of an irredeemable paper money known as assignat, secured by, what do you think, gold? No, by confiscated church properties. The consequences were unbelievably awful. Every American interested in freedom should read Andrew Dixon White's account of this debacle, Fiat Money Inflation in France, a small book, the classic on inflation, and obtainable from our foundation. In the Argentine, the government has had an annual expense, to use round figures, of 100 billion pesos. No more than 50 billion pesos could be collected by direct tax levies, thus a 50 billion peso annual deficit. What is their system? Merely turn on the presses and print 50 billion new pesos annually. One does not have to be much of an economist to understand that when the volume of money is increased, everything else being equal, the value of the money will decline. And when money declines in value, everything else being equal, prices will tend to rise. Imagine yourself as an Argentine citizen of some 20 years ago. You had money in the bank, you owned bonds, and had secured your future with pensions and insurance. Those investments today are practically worthless, and all because of the government's dilution of the money supply as the politically expedient means of financing excessive governmental activities. Let us now observe how inflation acts as an obscure and sneaky tax. My first visit to the Argentine was in 1941. $1 was exchangeable for 2 pesos. 25 years later, approximately 200 pesos to the dollar. But the dollar is worth about half of what it was then. Thus, if in 1941 you had deposited 1,000 pesos in Buenos Aires, they would today have the purchasing power of only 5 1941 pesos. In short, inflation would have taxed away 99.5% of your deposit. We in this country have a clever system of inflation. We monetize debt. That is, the more we go in debt, the more money we have. Should we spend $100 billion to put some men on the moon, we as citizens won't have that much less in dollars, but that much more in dollars. Since we began deficit financing and monetizing debt, we have increased our money supply enormously. The Russians, in my opinion, have the most honest system of dishonesty. Their system is both simple and crude. The government issues government bonds and forces the people to buy the government bonds. And then, after the people have bought the government cancels the government bonds. Many Russians, no doubt, are aware that there is some chicanery going on. Quite sincerely, I wish we were using the Russian system. For, were we doing so, more Americans than now would understand what is being done to them. The fiscal concomitant of the welfare state or socialism or governmental interventionism, call it what you will, is inflation. Politically, there is no way of financing interventionism except by inflating the money supply. So, if you wish to assist in ridding our country of inflation's havoc, there is only one thing you can do to be helpful, and that is to assist in wringing the socialism out of our economy. One of my hobbies is cooking, and therefore I am familiar with kitchen gadgetry, including the sponge. In one respect, a sponge resembles a good economy, it will sop up an awful lot of mess. But when the sponge is saturated, the sponge itself is a mess. The only way it can be made useful again is to wring the mess out of it. I hope my analogy is clear.
This is the end of side one. Do not fast forward your cassette. At this point, turn the cassette over to play side two.